Hello, everyone. I'm Kevin Winder, and thanks for tuning in to another podcast of Beyond Everything Radio. And like always, I have a question for you. What does it mean to be salt and light? Now, hold on a minute. If you're like most people, you're probably disregarding this already as stuff you already know. And yes, this is perhaps the most familiar sermon subject in the world, but given that everybody knows this, why do you suppose there has been so little transformation around it? I mean, why is there so much confusion on what it actually means? Join me now as we continue our examination of the Sermon on the Mount, and we learn to see beyond the salt and light and look closer at the intended audience. This fundamental shift requires a wider, more inclusive interpretation, which allows us to see beyond everything. Hello, everybody. Thanks so much for coming back to yet another episode of Beyond Everything Radio. I am your host. My name is Kevin Winder. I like to serve the world as an online pastor, author, and uncoach, among many other things that I do in my life, just like you. So glad to have you with me. Welcome to this podcast, especially if you're new, if you're checking it out. I can tell you this, you are in for something different. And different is good. Different stretches us. Different challenges us. Different causes us to think. It's not the same old cake with different frosting. Are you glad you're here? Well, you may not be, but I am. And thanks so much for tuning in. And folks, if you are not signed up for my weekly newsletter entitled Winder's Windshield, I invite you to go to my website, www.kevinwinder.com. Sign up for Winder's Windshield today. You'll get a part of my podcast, my blog, and all the new stuff coming out. You'll have an opportunity to stay in contact with me, which I think is great because why? Well, I love to hear from you. So if you have a question, if something I say just didn't quite ring with what you understand, which is quite often the case, I want to engage with you. I want to talk to you. I want to have a dialogue with you. I answer every single one, no matter how long it takes. So feel free to write me. Find it on Winder's Windshield. You can always reach me at kevin@kevinwinder.com. Remember, I spell my name like the number 7, K-E-V-E-N. Okay, folks, we are in a series on the Sermon on the Mount, and today is episode number 188. It is called The World is a Margarita, and You Are the Salt. That's right. Episode 188, The World is a Margarita, You Are the Salt. And what am I talking about? Well, folks, what we're doing is we're really looking. We're taking a deeper dive into the Sermon on the Mount, which is three chapters, chapters 5, 6, 7 of Matthew. And we're not doing an exegetical word-for-word study. We are doing a deeper, more drawn-out, I can't remember the exact name for this kind of study right now. I don't know why it escapes me. But essentially, you do all the hard work, the hermeneutics. You do all the textual analysis. You do all the etymologies. You do all of this stuff in the backdrop, right? And then you contextualize it, right? So I'm doing mostly contextualization. So this appeals to a much wider audience who don't, most people who don't geek out on all the nuances of the Bible interpretation and the science of hermeneutics. But it's in there, I assure you, it's in there. And this is the result is that I have to pull all of this out and reweave the entire structure, the entire message into the bigger narrative, which I believe I have uncovered. And so I invite you to just join in. We're here. I think we're in the fourth, maybe fifth episode so far. You're welcome to always go back and start checking them out. This one is on this passage called The Salt and the Light, which everybody knows, right? And it's kind of like watching a train wreck. What? What are you talking about, Kevin? Well, when you see a train wrecking, going off the tracks, there's this strange juxtaposition between wanting to turn away because you know there's kind of going to be a disaster and your compulsion to watch, right? The Sermon on the Mount, if you understand it, is precisely this kind of a collision. It is like a train going off the tracks. You see, the gravitational pull of those who are broken and desperate and oppressed are going to cling to every word as a savory morsel. And let's make no bones about it. The audience that Jesus was speaking to were primarily the poor, the broken, the desperate, the oppressed. But folks, our modern world, those who are listening to this today, and wherever this finds you, you probably are finding yourself in some state of brokenness, some state of oppression with institutional power. You might be desperate as well. And so the words of this sermon are like a savory morsel. But at the same time, if you read this sermon, it's like two magnets that are repelling one another. If you put them at the wrong ends, instead of attracting, they repel, they push against each other. Some are so strong you can't touch the pieces of metal. And if the sermon functions like that, because it scours with pinpoint accuracy the ugliness which we know lurks beneath our own facades. And so there's this self-appraisal when listening to the teachings in this sermon that totally exposes us. And yet at the same time, we know that we need that exposure, that nakedness, to move into a place of living free. And that's what Jesus is talking about. The whole idea of the kingdom is all about this. And we find this sermon, this passage, the salt and the light, kind of juxtaposed right in there. And so we're going to look at its contextual context. We're going to look at its textual context, right? So it's historical kind of context and then the textual context. Why? Because context is really, really important. Because Jesus' teaching is this human dance between hope and hopelessness. You see, he's not just running shine and lollipops and rainbows. He's talking about the desperate hopelessness of humanity and how we fall into it, how we live there, the living hell. And he's offering us an alternative, right? So we've all heard this sermon. I mean, the sermon on the salt and the light it has to be one of the top five most taught sermons in the history of any pulpiteer, right? And despite its familiarity, can we really say that there is a tangible transformation based upon this teaching? I mean, yeah, right? I mean, in your mind, you probably already know that salt adds flavor. You probably know that salt serves as a preservative. And so to be and live as the salt in the world, you're probably thinking you're adding something to the world. You're being a preservative of the world, right? And that light, we all know that light illuminates the darkness. I mean, that's a no-brainer, especially in our modern world. And that's what the idea is, that, oh, all these Christians are the light of the world, that they're illuminating the darkness, such as all the non-Christians in the world. This is how this passage is always taught. Even some of the most respected pastors that I've listened to always teach this as FUBU. And FUBU is for us, by us, right? Now, while this is true that salt adds flavor, it serves as a preservative, and the light illuminates the darkness, this is all true. My question is, has our culture, especially the Christian culture, has it become the attractive, savory influence that it was admonished to be by Jesus in this sermon? And I think an honest appraisal would have to conclude that this teaching hasn't sunk very deeply within us. Because if you look at our culture, the church is not the enviable life. The church is the diminished life. The culture looks at it and says, no thanks, by a long shot. Do you realize that the popular church delivery system is losing steam at approximately 1-2% per year? Mainline denominations across this country are closing shop very, very fast. Most churches are struggling, deeply struggling, just to stay afloat, to pay for their buildings, to pay for their programs. The church that's thriving and doing well is definitely the exception, okay? So why? Why is our culture looking at Christianity and saying, hey, that is not what we want and need? Is it just because they've taken this high road, or is something else going on that's wrong? And I think it's the latter, and I think this sermon, this passage particularly, opens this up for us to rethink what is Jesus actually saying. Because why? I think we missed something. I think modern Christianity is missing something. And folks, I've given close to 30 years in church ministry. And so let me just say, I've got enough skin in the game to be critical. I'm not throwing stones here. I'm not slinging mud. I'm offering critical analysis, okay? And perhaps modern Christianity sees itself. This is what I think is actually happening. It sees itself as preserving the world, right? If you look at the model of church engagement to the world, which they see as those people, non-Christians, their view is that Christ is to be against the culture. It's Christ against culture, right? When a true missional model of Christianity is that Christ redeems culture, right? We are culture creators, as many authors and people have said. And so if Christianity sees itself as preserving the world, then it does so by engaging in culture war, right? So you see this primarily on issues like abortion, the LGBTQ community, gun violence, school choice, right? Every life is precious in the womb, but every life on death row is not, right? This is the confusion that the church ends up being in. And I think the world looks at this and says, that's not shining a very bright light. You see, and if these kinds of subjects and issues are really what this is about, then we've not really taken a deeper understanding of this text. You see, if these types of activities of engaging against the culture constitutes being the light in the dark world, because you think you have to fight a war against the culture. It's always against the culture. Most churches are defined by what they are against, not what they are for, right? It begs the question, who is seeing these works? If this is the light, the works of being the light in the world, then who's seeing these works and who's glorifying the Father by them? And the answer is simple. The church is glorifying the Father by them. The rest of the world is not glorifying the Father by them. The rest of the world sees this as anything but the voice of God in the world. See, the influence just doesn't seem to go very far in our culture. When there is an influence, it seems mostly negative. Don't you agree? Folks, I think we can do better. So let's start with a clean whiteboard. I am going to offer you something that's just going to force you, if you're honest, to repackage this whole thing. Are you willing to do that if I do this? All right, so clean the whiteboard. Hear these words as they were said by Jesus. Matthew chapter 5, verses 13 through 16. You are the salt of the earth. But if the salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It's no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled under people's feet. You see, you are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden. Nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand, and it gives light to the whole house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. See, these are the words of Jesus. And this is going to create a major frame shift in you. But folks, let's think about what is the effect of the church in our culture. It is truly a church that has lost its saltiness. It is no good for anything except being thrown out and trampled under people's feet. That seems to be what we're seeing happen before our very eyes. I'm not saying it's all bad. It's not, folks. There's a lot that are doing very good work. But let's take an honest appraisal of the whole thing. And let's look at this text. And the very first thing we learn is that you, right, you does not refer solely to Christian people, as we have all been mistakenly taught. You see, scholars know this because there wasn't a single Christian in Jesus' audience, because the sermon predated Christianity. Stop right there and just take that in for just a second. This is not FUBU. This is not for us by us. This is not Jesus saying, okay, this is the secret sauce for our team. Every pastor who's ever taught this has taught you that you are the salt of the earth means that Christianity is the salt of the earth. He's not saying that because this sermon predates Christianity. Observing the correct cultural context, here's the hermeneutical hard work. You have to get context correct or else everything goes off the rails. Once you get the cultural and the textual context correct, which isn't really hard, you just have to do the work. But once you get it, you can't diverge from it and then have the text say whatever you want. And so observing the correct cultural context reorients this teaching into a new direction, one that is really inclusive of all comers, all hearers. This is exactly how it would have been in the hearers and in the mind of Jesus. He wasn't saying, hey, this is for my tribe. He was out in the middle of the desert after healing people and people, all kinds of people, religious people, rich people, poor people, sick people, a very diverse audience came to hear what he'd have to say. Is this really the Messiah? Is this really the guy who's going to change it all? Is this our new campaign? Is this where we're going to get the military might? Is this where we're going to rise up and fight Rome and the institutions? No, it wasn't all that, right? This audience had no prerequisites, right? They didn't have to be something, join a team, subscribe to a belief system in order for this text to apply, these promises to apply. The audience had no prerequisites. It applied to all hearers, just like it should today. See, the FUBU, the for us, by us lens, has to be removed if we would see this clearly. And to see it clearly is what we have to do if we're actually going to be transformed by it. The reason this very popular text is not really changing anything is because all we're doing is FUBUing it. So this is, removing that lens is much easier said than done, right? And so next we have to look at the passage within its textual context. I know it's a mouthful there. But we saw last week that the Beatitudes verses 1 through 10 were essentially the chiastic structure, this chiasm, outlined for the sermon. And that's the Jewish thought laid out in written form, which kind of starts with the headline. And the headline was last week's message about subverting institutional power. Power isn't going to like it if you are free, right? You can go back and check that out if you've missed it. But the thrust of the whole sermon is set on these rails. Right? The sermon is to offer a solution to the world. It's not a military solution. It's not a political solution. It's not a religious solution. It's a transformative solution from the inside out. It's a subversive solution to the world that moves the audience into authenticity and freedom. It does not move the audience into another institutional religion. Jesus did not come to start a new religion. The church, the original church, was made up of people with all kinds of belief systems. So the promises in this sermon are for all comers, not solely Christians, folks. And if this is true, then the passage on salt and light cannot be about waging war on the culture. Let's just stop there, full stop. The goal is not to wage war on the culture. Now, the audience would have wanted that, right? They would have wanted Jesus to get a bunch of zealots to rise up and overpower the oppressive religious system of the day, to rise up and overpower Rome and its oppressive system. And that is not what Jesus was doing. And that's not what the text is going to do now. And so to take it as a countercultural message is to completely miss it. It's to transform culture from the inside out in a subversive way. This changes pretty much everything, folks. It's not about how loudly and obnoxiously you proclaim your beliefs, which, by the way, is getting kind of annoying, right? You don't have to have a chrome fish on your car. Jesus isn't super happy with you because you listen to K-Love instead of some other music. Right? You've been culturally conditioned to think that all those things make you a better, better believer, like you're closer to God somehow than everybody else. Like you somehow got it. And this is why I spent the time talking about blessing when I did, as it creates this gag reflex in the mouth of people, because in some way you've thought yourself different than someone else because, you know, you're listening to Christian music. Folks, this is about being authentic, and there's going to be more on this later. When Jesus says, be perfect as my Father in heaven is perfect, the word there is really authentic. Be real. Now, it's just about finding who we truly are. This is about laying down your pseudonym. This is not taking up another identity found in institutional religion. This is about being freed from all of that. That's what the gospel does. See, it's not about promulgating a religion that hadn't even started yet. So salt and light cannot be about evangelism. It cannot be about getting more Christians across the line, saving more people, because it was never that in the intention of Jesus' words, because Christianity had not even started yet. And so what is Jesus saying? You see how one little shift on the makeup of this audience changes the whole trajectory of this passage? Salt doesn't make everything taste salty. It makes everything taste more like itself, up to a point, that is. At the point at which it's too much salt, it really loses its saltiness, doesn't it? It loses its ability to make things more like itself. See, the loss of saltiness is not just losing the salty taste and becoming bland. It's also when everything only tastes like salt. Too much salt in the soup, and all you taste is the salt. This, folks, is the state of the church and how it's lost its saltiness. It's turned everything into a counterculture. So we have to have Christian lawyers. We have to have Christian insurance. We have to have Christian motorcycle salesmen. We have to have Christian soap, Christian mints, Christian toothpaste, Christian every single thing in the marketplace is now Christianized. Those who want to do business with the secret handshake put an ichthus or the fish symbol on their advertisement. This is too much salt on the margarita. It's lost its taste. See, the salt on the margarita makes the flavors of the margarita stand out. But too much salt, or not enough, and the margarita is kind of meh, you know, meh. Now, Christianity, unfortunately, has, I believe, become meh in our world for the same reasons. I mean, it's not looked upon as the enviable life. Most Christian people are not becoming themselves. Do you realize that? You join a church and you become a Christian and you abandon your friends who don't go to church, right? You pick up a whole new set of friends and things to do and activities, and you abandon the life you came from, because that's what the church is doing, is trying to get you out of your life and into the church corporate life. That doesn't mean that you're becoming more yourself. What you're doing is you're giving your life over to a tribal identity in exchange for your true self. This is actually missing the thrust of Jesus' message. You have become more like the temple than you have Jesus' message of liberating you from the oppressive religion of the temple. See, the message of Jesus is that we are the salt of the earth. And earth there is the word ghee. Or it means land, it means earth, but primarily it means the people of the land, the people of the earth. In other words, we are the salt of the people. We are the flavor of the people to enable each other to stand out. We are in the business of promoting others. But is that true? Is that true only on Sunday? Because as soon as you get out of the parking lot, we don't want anybody to cut in front of us, because that would be us losing our spot, right? We're not really into promoting others if it means letting somebody merge. But this is what the teaching is. Promote others and let each other stand out. I mean, we're here to help each other become more us, not to lose our identity in institutions, but to find our true self grounded transparently in God. That's what Jesus is offering. It's we help each other become more us, not less us. But see, the work of the church has caused us to lose ourselves. And I think people know this. They sit there on Sunday mornings and they have these deep existential crises that they don't know how to resolve. They can't talk to their pastor because the pastor is just going to spin it and make them come right back into the institution. Say, this is how it all is, and you'll be okay, son, and just double down on your Bible reading and pray it through, and don't let Satan get you, and all this other stuff. But you're sitting there going, man, what is this really for? I'm not getting really anything out of this. I do this more for my kids or my wife or my husband. This is not really what I thought it was. I don't really believe all the things that this guy is saying. I have too many doubts, too many questions, and I don't know where to go or how to resolve them. Folks, I'm here to answer those questions. Just write me, okay? But I know you're there. I've heard you. You see, we're here to help each other become more, not less. And if this were happening, the church would be the most united and the most diverse place on the earth, because it would celebrate diversity. But right now, it doesn't. Like, we don't even like people of the same denomination if they vary a little bit on infant baptism or the way they do their worship. You know, oh my gosh, can you believe they use a pipe organ in there? Oh my word. Oh yeah, well, I heard that their worship pastor has skinny jeans and a neck beard, and they light candles and do incense. Oh my gosh. Folks, excuse me. Pardon me. Light in the same way can be blinding, right? But when it's spread around, it illuminates all the distinct features of every room. Light reflects off of every obstacle. It's creating shadow and depth and allows us to see. See, light is that pervasive influence that overcomes the darkness. So when Jesus says, hey, you are to be this pervasive influence that overcomes the darkness, it's you are to be this influence that allows the real us to stand out against the blackness. This is a hard challenge for the church. How does the church fare in this kind of critical analysis? Folks, this is reality. If we are the light of the world, this is another proof that this cannot be FUBU. This cannot be a text that is for Christians by Christians. This is a wider, inclusive story. And if we are the light of the world, and that world is cosmos, the first one, right? Cosmos, the universe, the people of the world. If you are the light of the people of the world, then the message is so clear that we are to shine upon each other. And it's supposed to enable us to see with clarity who and whose we really are. The church then should be liberating people back into their lives and back into the world instead of hijacking their lives, pulling them out of the world. Do you realize this, folks? Most churches' model is to take you out of your life because they think you live a sinful, dirty, evil life in the sinful, dirty, evil world. And its job is to pull you out and then cocoon you into this superstructure institution that is the saving grace of the world, and it's all corporate based. And if you just come and pay your taxes or pay your tithe and do your time, we're going to see you through in the end. That's the message. But that's not the intention of the author. That's not the founder's vision. How did the church take the teaching that was to illuminate all others and turn it into the evacuation threat that it has become? The church isn't an evacuation strategy. It's supposed to be this way where I have a certain amount of truth, you have a certain amount of truth. Neither one of us has all the truth, but each of us reflect a little bit of it. So I give the truth I have to you, and guess what? When I do that, I don't lose it. You give to me the truth that you have. And when you do that, you don't lose the truth that you have. You've now shared it. It's potentiated. Now we both share more truth, and you've lost nothing. This is the idea of serving, discipling, gaining from each other's light. You see, folks, there's no doubt that this text is focused upon all people, not just the tribe of not just the believers. This is not a message for the church, but for everyone. This means that all people, the Gi, the cosmos, are the flavor and influence one another. This presupposes diversity leading to unity and inclusion, right? This isn't about getting uniformity by extinguishing diversity, right? This is why we have all these discipleship classes to make sure you believe the right way, because half of you folks came from a Baptist church and they were Arminian, for crying out loud. You need to get the real Bible understanding and become reformed, right? And we can't get rid of diversity. The whole goal is to have diversity and unity, not uniformity without diversity. That's what we've done. So we polarize ourselves on our differences and fear, and we don't seek to grow from them. Precisely what the audience was experiencing under the oppression of the religion and the state of the day. And that's just exactly what we're seeing in the world today. So now we can hear the words of this sermon in a very fresh way. And I invite you to follow the path of humility, not certainty. Don't just disregard this and say, yeah, now I know. What you need to do is just like I had to do. You have to embody what it means to be salt and light. You have to take it in. You have to taste it. You have to savor the flavor. You have to become a flavor in the world. You have to become an influence in the world. Never forget that you have a light that needs to be shined. You, yes, you. No matter what you think of yourself, whether you think low or high, you have a light that must be shined in the world. Do not put a bowl over it, right? Warm your hands to everybody's fire. Savor the nuance of all comers. And once others see that, when everybody sees that you're doing that, they'll realize it's not only safe, but valued to be who they are. And then we will emerge from our pseudonyms, our fake IDs, and the world will never doubt the existence of God. The differences come together and create a body, a unified collective. This is the plan. This is how the subversive work works. So let's just not settle for the surrogate any longer. Let's own who we are, and let's let our light shine. Sure, some people won't understand. You go out and you shine your light and most people won't appreciate it. Trust me, folks. I have been shining my light, whatever brilliance it is, for a long, long time. And I can tell you, it takes a lot of work to get any traction at all. Most people simply disregard anything I say before they actually hear it. But let me just tell you this. And I hang on this as you will. I had an audience member tell me this, and it's been like gold in my mind, and I hope this is gold in your mind too. Unrecognized brilliance is still brilliance. It's still light. Think about that. Just because you're not going to make a big name or have a huge bandwidth of influence, that's okay. It doesn't have to be anything other than what it is. Just make sure you're shining it. You see, the freedom you possess by shining will be so contagious that those who have become the salt of the world will have the enviable life. That's how it happens. And that's what it means to be salt and light. In fact, through this lens, we can actually see this taking place all over the world. I hope now you'll have the eyes to see that too.